Hello, my name is Daniel Nenni, founder of SemiWiki, the open forum for semiconductor professionals. Welcome to the Semiconductor Insiders podcast series. If you have a topic you'd like us to cover, please post it on semiwiki.com and we'll get right to it. My guest today is Dr. Jason Kong, the Volganaw Chair for Engineering Excellence Professor at the UCLA Computer Science Department. He is the Director of the Center for Domain-Specific Computing and the Director of VLSI Architecture, Synthesis, and Technology Laboratory. Dr. Kong's research interests include novel architectures and compilation for customizable computing, synthesis of VLSI circuits and systems, and quantum computing. Welcome to the podcast, Jason.
Thanks, Dan, and thanks for having me here.
First of all, congratulations on the 2024 Phil Kaufman Award. That's quite an honor.
I'm also very much honored and humbled to receive this award.
So let's go back to the beginning. How did you first get started in semiconductors, and what interested you in EDA?
Well, I actually took a rather winding path to get to semiconductor and EDA. My interest in high school was in mathematics, and I have did various kind of math competitions and won some competitions at the city level. By the way, I've grown up in Beijing, China, and I was elected to the national Olympic team for competition. As I was about to enter the college, I got an invitation with a few others, the competition winners, to visit the Peking University's math department. Peking University is like a Harvard equivalent here in U.S., back in China. So I almost decided to go with the math department at Peking University. Except on the way back, I just couldn't resist my curiosity trying to figure out how computers could compute faster than human beings. I said, that might be an interesting subject to find out. So I made a stop at the computer science department. I remember that was a very early days of the computer science department at the Peking University. It was in a kind of a staff residential building. They only took the first floor to set up some administrative offices. Nevertheless, I got a warm welcome through an old gentleman. He kind of explained the various courses in the program, logic designs and the data structures, algorithms, so on and so forth. So it really got me excited. So I made the last minute change. I enrolled in the computer science department. In fact, the story is that after I enrolled in the department, I'm trying to thank this wise man for all the advice he had given to me. I looked for all the professors, he's not there, and all the associate professors, he's not there, all the lecturers, he's not there. It turned out he was a staff member that responsible for entering all the grades. No wonder he's very familiar with all the courses. Remember, these are the days before internet back in the early 1980s. So nevertheless, I got into the computer science department, but I still have a lot of interest in math. The foundation of a computer science, that mathematical foundation of computer science, is actually discrete math. It's not calculus, not quite linear algebra either. And I really enjoy discrete math and has sets, graphs, relations, and so on and so forth. So we were using this book called The Discrete Mathematics by Professor C.L. Liu. It's an excellent book that I still recommend to my students to take a look at, even 40 years later. So I said, wow, I want to study under Professor Liu. So that's how I applied to for a PhD program at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. That's where Professor Liu was teaching. When I got there, however, I remember in our first meeting or two, he mentioned, Jason, that I'm still doing discrete math, but my interest is really moving into more application side, in particular the computer aided designs for integrated circuits. Now you think back, it makes sense, because a big part of the theoretical computer science is to deal with complexity. And back in the 1980s, the VLSI design is the big data problem we have there. We have here today, right? So the largest man-made objects in the world with millions of transistors. So everyone cares about how the algorithm scales. And if you care about algorithm efficiency, that's the battleground to showcase your algorithms. So So with that transition, I got into computer-aided design, and I took a number of courses. I did an internship at 1987 with Dr. Brian Priest at the Xerox PARC, and later on I had a second internship at the National Semiconductors. So that's how I really get interested, get into the EDA and semiconductor in general.
That's a good story. So how did you decide to focus on FPGA design and not chip design?
Okay, that's a good question. First of all, to clarify that the FPGA designs and is part of the chip designs. By the way, just for the audience who are not too familiar with the term FPGA, it stands for Field Programmable Gate Arrays. It's a specialized chip you can design in your office on your desk. The reason you can do that is that it has pre-designed logic gates and interconnects, everything already. All you need to do is to customize the interconnect, how these cells will be connected, and also customize the function of these cells. In fact, these functions are very simple. These functions, what they have are basically lookup tables where you store the truth table of a Boolean function. So so it is something you can get started even today in your office, on your desk, or in your bedroom, without spending millions of dollars to a fabrication at a TSMC or a Global Foundry. So I call that a poor man's solution to do chip design. On the other hand, because you can reconfigure it in a minute or in a second, sometimes in the milliseconds, I'll also say it's fast man's that the chip design solutions. If you can think very fast, keep coming up with new ideas, FPGA is your best platform to experiment. So that that's one reason I stick with FPGA throughout my career. There's a second, a lot more practical reasons that why I started with FPGA. My PhD thesis was all on physical design, basically to figure out how logic elements will be connected and how they will be routed on a VLSI chip. But after I finished my PhD, I also want to find something new and different to do. And at that time, this is the early 1990s, logic synthesis was very popular. It's also getting important. So I look around and UC Berkeley, IBM has done a tremendous amount of research in logic synthesis, but it's all targeted for ASIC design. And at that time, FPGA just started at a few schools, and Berkeley, Stanford, University of Toronto are having some initial investigation. I said, hey, this is an area I can probably start with more or less equal footing, right, with my peers. And so that's how actually we started a research program there. The first problem we studied was called the technology mapping problems. If you work with a foundry, TSMC at that time, also TI and many others as foundries, the first thing is that you figure out how do you get your Boolean networks mapped to their standard cell families. For FPGAs, that there's only one cell, right? I mentioned it's a K input lookup tables. So at that time, probably it's a four input lookup tables. They can implement any four input functions in the world. It's a brand new problem as well. It's very different. So we studied it for over a year, and then we had a huge success. We developed the optimal algorithms, runs in polynomial time, called the flow map. And not too many EDA problems can be solved exactly optimally and also in polynomial time. So that success also gave us a lot of encouragement to stay in this area.
Yeah, I agree completely. I think FPGA design is kind of a gateway to chip design, but some people go from chip design to FPGA, but it is a critical part of our industry for sure. So I know you from AutoESL, and you know, it's an FPGA synthesis and optimization company, and it was acquired by Xilinx. But what are some of your other entrepreneurial endeavors?
Actually, my very first company was called A+. It's not because I'm a professor, I give out the only work with students with A plus grades. It stands for Advanced Logic, Physical and Logic Unified Solutions. This is target for FPGAs. You may remember that towards the end of the 1990s, this interconnect bottleneck is a big problem. That was the first time when you take longer to communicate a signal, even on a 1 millimeter by 1 millimeter square die, right? And then compute the signal. So that transition from a logic dominated design to interconnect dominated design is a big deal. So there's a number of startups that formed at that time, the two prominent ones. One is the Magma Design System, later on acquired by Synopsys. The other one is the Monterey Design System. We feel that we need similar solutions for FPGA designs. In fact, when I talk about the mapping it to lookup tables, right? People just counting levels to calculate the delay, which is very inaccurate because how these lookup tables are connected will contribute a great deal to the final performance. So we said we got to combine logic designs and physical designs together. So that's the thesis behind that. The Cypress Semiconductor was now our first customer. In fact, they talked to us even before the company was formed. They interested in using flow map solutions to evaluate their new FPGA families. They also interested in a more kind of a more advanced forward-looking compiler. So I was very grateful even before we sort of, have the team, they're willing to commit a $2 million purchase order so that how we get started. It's a very unique situation. We didn't take any VC money, and it was all bootstrapping from a customer support. Later on, we had also Altera, QuickLogic, Actel as our customers. So company was eventually acquired by Magma. That's in 2003. Magma was also very interested in applying the same technology, not just to FPGAs, but also to something called the structure ASIC. You may remember the idea is similar to gate arrays, but it's a lot more advanced, where you have very regular logic laid out in the silicon substrate. And then all you need to do is to do one or two layer metal customization to connect them together. It was very hot in a decade of 2000 for a while, but I think the big reason was probably the lack of IP support. They did not quite take off. So that was the one company. Another one, after Auto ESL, and a few of us, and in fact, the one UCLA graduate, one USC graduate, that Xiaojin Yang is the lead, talked to me to start another company. Originally, we're thinking about doing physical design, physical synthesis, but I encouraged them to look at another problem. Basically, it's to speed up the place and route. For those of you who design FPGAs, you know it's very flexible. You can reprogram it in a bit with a bit stream in less than a second. But how do you get that bit stream? You have to do place and route to get it, and that place and route process is getting longer and longer. These days, you can easily get 12 hours, 24 hours to generate a bit stream. So the focus with the company was to say, hey, can we really get it done in much shorter time, let's say in an hour or less than an hour, with the goal at that time we're thinking to make FPGA as a computing fabric. So today, if you go to your CPU, type in C compilation, CC, or go to GPU, type CUDA compilation, you don't wait for an hour to get a solution. You don't wait for 12 hours to get a solution. So if FPGA ever going to be a computing fabric, so that we think the compilation time was has to be much shorter. Not many people knows about this company because even before we get to the computing part, it turned out there's another big application area that was in emulation, that people has to map their designs to a big box of FPGAs to validate the functionality. When they see a bug, they will edit the bug and then reiterate. So that iteration process has to be fast. So Xilinx very quickly realized the value of the company when the company was still at a very early stage, 4 or 5 people that they acquired the company. But nevertheless, that's a success. And the last one we started being also exited was in about 2016, 2017. You may remember that the Intel at that time made an announcement they acquired Altera because they were very successful in having FPGAs used in data centers, especially with Microsoft. And soon after that, that AWS cloud from Amazon, they introduced sliding FPGAs called the F1 cluster. It's still around that you can go to use it for $1.50 an hour. So I use it for my teaching at the undergraduate and graduate courses in the F1 cloud. So that was the setting. We want to FPGA to be a lot easier to use that for the average software programmers. You can use it as a special instance, right, to accelerate your applications. So we come up with a software flow very similar to multi-core programming. Some of you in the audience may know about the OpenMP program to program Intel multi-cores. So for us, it's exactly the same way. You add a few paradigms. Basically, there are three paradigms. You add parallel, or you add pipeline to the loops, or you add tile to decide where to bring in a chunk of data to reuse. So that was the basically the thesis behind the company. Year 2020, I think the company is being acquired by Xilinx. Now Xilinx is part of the AMD. So those techniques are being integrated into the Vitis HRS tool, high-level synthesis tool, which was actually the AutoESL. They got it from AutoESL acquisition. So basically their high-level synthesis solution is getting bigger and better.
Right. Yeah. Did you remember a company called Gatefield? It was an FPGA company.
Yeah, I think I remember that by name, but I don't think I have a much of association with the company.
Yeah, I spent quite a bit of time in the FPGA business, and I worked for Gatefield. It was a spin out of Zycad, and Actel bought it. And it's a flash based FPGA. But I tell you, FPGAs are just so critical in the semiconductor ecosystem. I don't think people really understand that. So I appreciate, you know, your thoughts. You know, you're noted for being an inspiring and accomplished educator. I mean, I know you. I've been on panels with you. You're a mentor and a role model for generations of students. You know, the question I have is, how do you inspire your students today? I mean, students change over the generations, and you've been teaching a long time. How do you inspire today's engineering students?
Well, it's a complex question. I don't think I have a single answer to that. There are a few aspects I think are important to get students inspired. But first, without saying that we have a very high admission standard, the students we got are very excellent students. But nevertheless, it's more important to keep them challenged. And I would say the number one is probably to get exciting problems for them to work on. That I mentioned early on that we talked about, hey, how can we design for lookup table based devices, right? That instead of a standard cell family based devices. When 3D IC came out, we were the first ones to investigate that how do we now place logics in three dimensions. And when interconnect become a bottleneck, we were the first one to decide to investigate what's the topology that it matters or not, right? That if you connect it using a tree, what type of tree is suitable for delay optimization? Spanning trees, Steiner trees, what kind of a Steiner tree? I think if we ask the right question and if we ask the challenging question, the students will stay engaged and being inspired. That's one aspect. The second one, I will say that being a professor, part of my job is to amplify their curiosity. So they come into the field, they have certain questions in mind, and they have certain maybe ideas that they want to implement. But we should just keep that momentum going and amplify that. For example, some students may come up with a heuristic to solve a problem or some models to train to implement machine learning models. And I mean, a question to ask a lot is that, how good is that? How do you measure the optimality? I remember in year 2000, early part of that, we have done that multiple generation of research on circuit placement. We see improvement, the 20-30%. But it's still, that was the right time to ask the question, how far are we from optimal solutions, right? That in fact, that these are million gate circuits, how do you know the optimal solution? So eventually we come up with a clever way to construct a set of circuit families where we know the optimal solution, two or do not know, we gave it to them, we measure, and it turned out that turned out to be 60%, 90%, 120% away from optimal. So that gave us a lot of motivation to go with that. For students, it's important. I mean, it's just one example to amplify their curiosity. They have been working on the problem for a while, so then that's an important way to keep them stay engaged. I will say finally, just being a professor, it's also important to be a cheerleader, being the first one to congratulate them when they have some fantastic result and then share the spotlight. Or for all the publications we have, and I let students to go to conferences to give presentations, unless it's a keynote that the organizer specifically asked for me. I think getting that exposure either at the presentation or the poster sessions, it's I think it's a very important factor for students to get excited and then continue their research. I'm sure
that. Yeah, I agree.
More aspects, but I think these three I would like to highlight.
Yeah, I think challenging students. I remember in my undergraduate, being challenged was the big deal. You know, we wanted to do new things and accomplish all sorts of amazing things. But my mentor was also an entrepreneur like yourself, and I credit him with getting me into startups because I've done startups most of my career. And I'm just wondering how many of your students are doing startups, you know, based on your influence and your experience.
In fact, all these three, four companies I mentioned, I started together with my students or postdoc. One thing I want to mention is that there is a new startup going on, actually, at this moment called the RapidStream Design Automation, started with two of my PhD students, and for the spirit of full disclosure, I'm also a co-founder and the chief scientific advisor. So the idea is, again, coming back to FPGA, to make it going that faster. But at this time, the idea is to be able to pipeline the interconnect automatically. This become a big problem, as you know, these days people are going to with the chiplet designs, right? When you go with chiplet design, the first thing is that you're going to cross the chip boundary, go to the substrate, then enter another chip. So that interconnectivity is very long. How do you tolerate that? It's impossible to cross it in single clock cycle. You can say, okay, I got to cross in multiple clock cycles, but how many? Where do you put down these registers, right, the flip-flops? And also you cannot do it locally because you cannot do it whenever you see a long wire, it says, okay, I will cross it in three steps, I put in two registers. But then you may mess up the arrival time of the signal because it gets to get the signal, another signal they computed same time. So you have to speed up or slow down the signals on other passes to the same destination. So we now have a way to solve that global optimization problem as part of the high-level synthesis solutions. My student, I give them credit to coin this term, is the high-level physical synthesis. Then maybe you can publicize that, you know, that the seminar wiki. So that's just one example. They just graduated. They came to talk to me about this idea. By the way, this is based on two best paper awards, right? The one is called the AutoBridge. The other one is called the RapidStream in FPGA 2020. Another one is 2021 or 2022. But then nevertheless, that once you show the success example, the students follow. So they came to talk to me. There's actually other students in the lab that are working with me on the machine learning and either acceleration or machine learning models for different applications. Now they are thinking about with some of the exciting results they have on that dramatic reduction on data training sizes, whether they can take it to commercialization. And also, then you're right that even for the students who have went through the process once, it's very easy for them to give them the motivation to continue. At least I can think of a two from the early A-plus days. They all, and they basically they had done their work with Magma, and they came out to have their own business also in the EDA area. And the most recent example is Falcon Computing. We have a key member that who actually a main contributor for the Falcon Computing solutions. Now he came out and the data company that this is DU with Professor Song Han did this company called the Omi ML, just being acquired by NVIDIA at the last year. So it's a very successful effort, a very successful exit as well. Definitely this success inspires more success.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, thank you so much. That was very well articulated. You know, I'm a big fan of yours, Jason. You've accomplished so much. Final question, you know, what's next for you? And don't say retirement.
Well, I hope it's I can have another kind of a few years good run. So I feel I'm almost like a last, like a 15 minutes of final exam. You know, figure out what to do next. Some students has already turned in their papers. you're saying, can I solve one more problem? So three areas going on in my lab. One is that I really want to continue this effort that you can say it started with high-level synthesis, but we go way beyond that. I will use the term to democratize chip designs. The way I see it is that we need to have a much easier way to let software people to create their own customized accelerators. Because if that's the direction, then we should empower the application developers. And by the way, that Professor Mark Horowitz had a keynote speech at DAC last year, repeating very much the same theme. And, we had a position paper published in CACM, Communication of ACM, in January of 2020. That I welcome everyone to read that. So that's kind of our vision. So I would say the first part of the half of my career was to enable hardware designer to design chips. The second half of my career, since that 2010 or so, really trying to enable software programmers to design chips. For example, we have outreach program at UCLA just in the last two summers. And we have high school students on campus. They come here to learn Python programming, machine learning. I give them a lecture. I says, all of you can design chips. I tell them this, for example, this high-level synthesis, glorified high-level synthesis tool we have called the Merlin. How do you automate it on that with machine learning and with, so they can do it in AWS and spend a few dollars and get a chip design. I do that routinely in my CS courses that students in 1 week design accelerator for convolutional neural network. So they do feel the sense of accomplishment. So that's something I want to continue to enable. So that's one area. And then related to that, a big effort to further automate is that maybe you don't even need to give pragmas. So today you have to say in your C program, this loop I want to parallel, this loop I want to pipeline. And the tool will take care of everything else, which is quite remarkable, right? Think about it, that your array will be partitioned, your data will be bought up from the off-chip memory to on-chip memory, and then your finance name machine will be generated to enable pipeline. But I want to go one step further. You even don't have to give any pragmas and let basically AI ML to figure out where to put it. We have a sequence of a paper on this time on this topic. I think there's a lot of potential in further automating the chip design process. My goal is really to get this to the hands of high school students. A lot of my colleagues says, wow, that in EWE tell me that, wow, that look, the CS enrollment has been doubling and redoubling, and the E environment, the enrollment is really dropping consistently. But I also ask them a question. I says, well, the high school students can write C program, Python programs in there in the first or second years in high school. So how many of them can design chips? So if you don't make them that easier, accessible, so I think that trend is going to continue. Remember the days when we can assemble the pocket radio, right, from a Radio Shack. That's the kind of excitement you want to get with high school students. And then finally, we are in Southern California, and we have in Northern California, we have Silicon Valley. I would say here we have Quantum Beach, that Google's quantum effort, Amazon's effort, it was all in Southern California. It just not out of a convenience, but if you look at the scaling roadmap, right, at some point that the Moore's Law, Moore's Law scaling has clearly slowed down, at some point had to stop. Of course, there's other ways to scale in three dimensions out there, but we also have to actively thinking about alternative computing technologies, not as a replacement, but as an augmentation. So in that context, I think quantum computing is quite interesting. So we have a very active program now looking at the design automation problems or compilation problems for quantum computing.
Yeah, I like Quantum Beach. I think that'll catch on.
Okay. So I was thinking that what you say that at my Kaufman dinner speech, this is one term I came out with.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Jason. I appreciate the time, and it's nice to get to know you a little bit more, and I will see you at the dinner.
Yes, look forward to seeing you on November 6th, Mr. Jose.
That concludes our podcast. Thank you all for listening, and have a great day.